brings you inspiring people with visions of a viable future for life on Earth that includes humans.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Hey, Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell you the story from the inside out. So make sure to check us out on KBOO Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m.
Oh, what a world. KBOO 90.7. Dasha T said that.
Welcome to another episode of Civic Cypher. I am your host, Ramses Jai.
Yes, he is. And they call me Q Ward.
Stick around. Got a great show lined up for you today. We're going to share some things you might not know about. If you are not a Black person, growing up Black may seem like a foreign concept to you, and that's okay, because again, that's not your reality. But there are some things that happen that shape our reality as adults that we feel like if we share them, maybe we'll find a way to relate to each other a little bit more easily, more readily. So we're gonna take a moment today to make sure that we discuss how some experiences can and do shape the lives of people who are born Black in this country, and maybe even some ideas on how you can address those, ask about those experiences, and hopefully we can create a little bit more empathy as we relate to each other. Also, we're going to tell a story about how Civic Cypher came to be.
Wow.
Someone reached out to us and was like, you know, kind of asking how we came up with the idea for the show. And we haven't told this story in this space. And so we're going to take some time to let you know the origins of this show, why we think it's important, and what we hope the show will accomplish in long form. We kind of give bits and pieces here and there. But today we're going to lay it out in full detail for you so that you will have it all. And then, of course, our Way Black History Fact, we're going to be talking about the Urban League. You may be familiar with the NAACP, but today we're going to celebrate the Urban League. But first and foremost, we are going to discuss some Ebony Excellence. How's that sound, Q?
It sounds very exciting, shall we?
We shall. So today's Ebony Excellence is sponsored by Hip Hop Weekly Media. We got a little tidbit from JP Morgan Wealth Management. As it turns out, Black women are the fastest growing demographic of entrepreneurs in the US, with nearly 2.7 million businesses nationwide. So shout out to Black women one time. The number of businesses owned by Black women grew 50% from 2014 to 2019, representing the highest growth rate of any female demographic. Black females accounted for 42% of all women who operated a new business during that time and represented 36% of all Black employers. And they're not letting up. In the U.S., 17% of Black women are in the process of starting a new business compared to 10% of white women and 15% of white men. Motives for creating a new business include producing a source of income or following a dream. So we always want to make sure that we're showing our support.
Amen.
To Black women. And, you know, as a side note, and a personal experience, I have a sister. You know, this is the closest lens that I have outside of our producer, Maggie, Ms. Maggie, aka Maggie B. Noah.
She knew
her perspective. My own little sister once worked for a doctor. And, you know, my sister is an actual smart person, like on paper, a brilliant mind, like for real. And I remember the way that this doctor mistreated my sister and devalued her ideas and so forth. And so my sister now works for herself because of that. So I could definitely see this reality taking shape for Black women across the country traditionally that undervalues them. So shout out to Black women one more time for our ebony excellence. And that is a great segue into what we're talking about today. It just kind of felt important and timely based on some conversations we were having this week, Q and myself and Maggie, about what it means to be, you know, a Black man, Black person in this country, and some of our traumas and insecurities and things that have helped shaped us as adults that started in our childhood. And so, you know, there's some crazy things that, you know, if you're not Black, you might not be aware of these things that are specific to Black people or that are specific to me, an individual, but only could happen to me as a result of me being Black, as a result of me, as you'll find out, not having straight hair. I think that it's worth sticking around for. So I want to tell a quick story to help set the stage. So, you know, I was born in Compton, California. I lived there the first part of my life. That, of course, very much shaped how I viewed and still view the world. So a quick story there. When I was younger, there was a lot of violence there. Of course, it was in the 80s, so there was a lot of drugs and that sort of stuff. I had a friend. I had two friends, Keith and David. Keith ended up dying. Remember, we were kids, little kids. Keith ended up getting shot and he died in front of his house in the street. I remember that. And I remember everybody screaming. And it was kind of a sad day, but I didn't really get to process that. And I remember thinking, dang, I hope I make it to 20. Now, most people, when they're that young, they hope that they make it to 18, or they anticipate turning 18 because then they'll be in a grown-up, or 21 because then they can be a real grown-up, or 25 because they can rent a car, or whatever age it is. But I thought 20 was the magic number because where I lived, whenever people talked about death or these crazy things happened, they would always be like, oh, such and such, he was only 13 or 17 or 15, and the teen part stood out, and that meant that it was a tragedy. So because I knew how numbers worked, I thought 20 was the magic number. And if I could just make it to 20, then I will have made it. It's crazy. And so that very much shaped my life. You know, I was in college when I turned 20, and 20 was when I let my hair started to grow. I felt that I was going to be myself, and every other day beyond that was a bonus. Now, of course, I moved out of Compton when I was very young. And I knew that life was not just, okay, you're born to die, you know, but that number stuck with me. That in mind, when I first came to Arizona, I had a friend, his name was Kevin. For those that are really into hip hop culture, that watch a lot of interviews, you may know the name Bootleg Kev. Well, I met Kevin when he was 3 years old, and I was 7. And so we grew up together. The reason he's super into hip hop is because of me. You know, I love Kevin. I always did love Kevin. And Kevin was very fortunate. his parents had money and they believed that you can buy more than one Christmas present for your kid at Christmas. And so Kevin would get all these Christmas presents every year for his birthday and Easter holiday, like all this stuff. So Kevin had mad toys, right? As you're growing up, that's fun, you know. And every time I'd go and hang out with Kevin at his house, I'd bring my video games, and later I'd bring my CD books and that sort of stuff. But Kev had toys. He's a few years younger than me, so he was still on that. Well, after, you know, a couple years of knowing each other and playing with each other, Kevin's toys would always go missing just because he had too many of them. And there was this gripping fear that I experienced every time one of Kevin's toys went missing. And instead of me thinking, okay, he's a child who lost his toy, it's in the couch, it's in the back of the car, something like that, I was so worried that his mom was going to think I stole it, because I understood at that young age that there was a stereotype and a stigma of being Black that meant that people assume that Black people steal, right? And of course, I never stole anything, but I would always be so, I would rush to help him find the toy, and I would pray that I wasn't the one who found it. Because if I'm the one who found it, then they could conclude that I hid it in that location, right? And it wasn't until years later, I'm talking my early 30s, when I finally told Kevin's mom about that. I was like, oh, I used to hate when Kevin lost his toys. And I told her the story I just told you.
Probably broke her heart.
Broke her heart. She cried. Her and her husband, Kev's dad, Charlie, they were like, yo, how could you ever think that we would ever think that you would do that? And I'm like, anyway. That's one story. We got a few to get off.
It sucks that that was a thing for you, though.
Yeah, it really was.
Because at that age, you had to understand that you lived in a world that mostly did view Black people that way, and just had to hope that this family was different, and had to be really like trapped by that fear.
Yeah, man.
That sucks.
Yeah. But so you are from a different place.
Yeah, I'm from a city they call Motown, the Motor City, if you will.
Talk about it.
Detroit, Michigan.
That's right.
At one point, the world's motor capital, maybe still. At one point, the world's murder capital.
Mm.
A very, very unproud but true statistic. And in the 80s, when I grew up, the early 90s, when I was in Detroit, the Black population exceeded 80%. And if you can imagine being somewhere where the Black population is 80%, you can spend your entire life never seeing anyone that isn't Black. So that was my truth. A very, very interesting thing about our relationship, or our people's relationship with law enforcement, is that not only was everybody in my city Black, but my mother's brother and my father's brother, Detroit police officers for my entire childhood. One a detective, one an inspector, so respected, like career-long police officers. And then my Uncle Harold married a Detroit police officer. So we were really kind of ingrained. So seeing law enforcement was very normal for me.
Mm-hmm.
And because everyone was Black, it wasn't until I was an adult that I had some of those, oh, this is different experiences with law enforcement. But being a child in Detroit, especially growing up not wealthy, a lot of things that are true about growing up a Black child in this country never dawned upon me until, once again, I grew up. All of my neighbors were in the same financial situation as my mom, all of my classmates. So not only were we all Black, but we were all poor. So it wasn't like people were stunting on you. And now, as I started to grow up, I would notice that my friends who had both parents at home, they had more things than I did, right? Name brand shoes and clothes.
Right.
But just the way that my world got to be shaped around Black people was actually really cool. But there was a duality. My uncle, my mother's brother, by the nature of being an inspector in the Detroit Police Department and then marrying a Detroit police officer, two parents with what were considered good jobs, they did well.
Mm-hmm.
So I did sometimes get to see how the other side lived, right? You would go to spend a night over there And you would want that night to turn into a week or a month, or mom, can I just stay here? Because they have a swimming pool and a pantry. I won't even get into a pantry when you're a young black kid and you've never seen anything like it. Like, that was what would be a special occasion grocery store trip for me, was just every like Tuesday for, you know, for their house.
They got extra food outside the refrigerator.
Yeah, like lots of it. You know, all the snacks, you know, anything you could possibly want. I remember the first time my heart fluttered was because I saw Tina Turner. So imagine being very much a child and thinking that the most glorious thing you've ever seen is Tina Turner, right? So that's what growing up surrounded by black people does to you subconsciously, right? That Tina Turner in all her glory, it couldn't get any better than that. And I'm proud of that to this day. My first crush in my whole life was Tina Turner. And you know, they later made a movie about her. I bought the first tickets, probably printed. Like I stood in line to see What's Love Got to Do with it. And I learned a lot about her life and career that I didn't know. And that was a little jarring. But once again, this is me going to see my childhood crush's movie. Simultaneously, however, and forgive me for saying your name if you ever hear this, because I have not seen her since I was maybe 6 years old, but Mary Kay. Mary Kay was my cousin Leslie and Natalie's friend. And Mary Kay was white. She was the second person that I had a crush on. And mostly because if there's a such thing as not seeing color, four-year-old kids playing in the swimming pool. This wasn't a romantic crush because we were four, but I thought she was pretty and she wasn't my cousin. And that was kind of all that mattered, right? That she was white is something I think about today. That absolutely didn't matter when I was 4 and 5 years old playing in my uncle's swimming pool with her. And it clearly didn't matter to her either, because when other family members would come over and she was there, her interactions with them were just as warm and just as friendly. And clearly her parents had to think it was okay, because every summer or every holiday that we were at Uncle Harold's in the pool, she was there too. So just a really, really interesting dynamic. And I'll touch more on how that shifted a little later on in the show. But growing up in an all black city, because 82% of a city being black, that city's black.
Yeah, real black.
Right. I had a couple teachers that weren't, but even most of my teachers, most of the adults and children that I saw from preschool to graduation were black. It was a bit of a utopia and kind of a really, really dope experience to grow up in. However, going to college forever changed the entire scope of how I saw being black in this country.
So I want you to tell that story. Let me get this one off real quick. Now, I'm from California. We're all mixed up over there. Then I moved to Arizona. Even more mixed up. You know what I mean?
Or even less mixed
up. The opposite. There's not a lot of black folks in Arizona, in Phoenix. Another thing that happened to me growing up is, you know, I get that you listen to us on the radio, so you probably haven't seen how we look, but I have hair on my head. It's a big old afro. I've had it for always. And, you know, it's, my hair just grows that way. This is what it does. So I'm very proud of it, and I don't cut it because it's like, it's my way of kind of proclaiming who I am, who I was meant to be. Nature's expressing herself through my hair. God is expressing God's self through my hair and every other part of me, and you, not taking anything away from anybody. But you know, I've always had, well, not always, but for a huge chunk of my life, I've had long hair and kept it that way. And when I got a little older, I remember somebody, so you know how like you'll go to a friend's house, you know, a lady friend, or maybe you're a lady yourself listening to us, and you like comb your hair in the shower or comb through conditioner or whatever, and you pull the hair off of the comb and you set it on the wall of the shower or whatever so that you can clean it up later, right? So the hair is kind of like stringy, straight looking hair. It's kind of a little soapy and just sits in the corner. Anyone else who sees that sees hair. This hair is from a long haired individual that is in the corner of the shower. Well, my hair is just as long. It just doesn't hang to my shoulders because it grows in circles. You know what I mean? It just kind of stays where it's at. It just keeps growing in circles. which
coils, if you will.
Coils, yeah. And this is how you get the cool looking afro situation. I think it's cool. The thing is, if I comb my hair, which I do, and I always have to, you know, I have to do the same thing, right? So I remember one time I went to camp. I might have been in the eighth grade, ninth grade, something like that. You know, comb my hair like normal. And then I like took the hair from the comb. This wasn't in the shower, but I took the hair from the comb and I threw it into the trash. You know what I mean? And I just left it in like a wastebasket inside of the cabin where we were camping. And one of the people that came into the cabin, this person wasn't like being mean or being racist or anything like that. That's not what this story's about. This person was unfamiliar with hair not attached to my head, right? So when they see this clump of hair that looks like a little tiny afro that you can fit in the palm of your hand, looks at it and said something like, it looks, oh my God, look at this. It looks like a bug created a nest or something like really, that they weren't trying to say anything about me.
Yeah, didn't intend to be mean.
Right, but the way that I heard it was like, oh my God. And the you know, everyone else was clowning, was like, you know, whatever they were saying, I don't know. And then over time, I heard things like, you know, when you have like thick black hair in the shower, when you come across that, a lot of people think that it's body hair, we'll say. Well, my hair is all thick and black, you know what I mean? And it's curly, right? So this thing kind of grew in me, this fear of leaving my hair anywhere, especially in the shower, because I didn't want anybody else to find my hair that came from my head. I have to comb my hair and take care of it same as everybody. But I became so embarrassed about having to take care of my hair because it sheds. It's just what human beings do. All of our hair sheds. It's a natural thing. But leaving it in the shower became like kind of traumatic for me, so much so to where as recently as we'll call it 2000 and maybe 17, maybe 16, 17, I was in Vegas at a Hilton. I was there under like a diamond account, right? DJing for New Year's Eve. And I found myself in the shower cleaning up my hair because I didn't want the housekeepers to come in after seeing me in that room to think that I had somehow violated or disrespected the bathroom and for them to be grossed out by my hair on my head. So it's something that stayed with me well into adulthood. And again, growing up and getting those traumas of just not being white, just being different. And I'm sure that Hispanic people and, you know, everybody has their own versions of these stories, but I think that by us talking about it, we can kind of relate to each other. Now, you went away to college. Tell me more about this, Q.
Well, before going away to college, you have to understand, I said something earlier, and I said it so fast you may not have caught it.
What's that?
Almost everybody was black.
Okay.
I had teachers my whole life that weren't. But you have to understand, with my life and the way that I view non-black people in America was very much shaped by my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
But think about it. The city, 82% black. But you can drive, right, from the most southern part of Detroit to out of Detroit is, I'm sure you guys have seen the movie 8 Mile. That distance is 8 miles, literally, from the southernmost part of Detroit. So as far inward as you can go south,
mm-hmm,
to north of the city, out into the north suburbs. 8 miles, and you're out of the city.
Mm-hmm.
All of these teachers could have worked in the suburbs and not had to move, like literally cross the street, go across the street, across 8 Mile, you're not in Detroit anymore. The property value increases, your salary increases, the crime rate drops, like all of this was true. So these teachers that were not black that chose to work in inner city Detroit public schools had a really, really genuine affection and place in their heart for teaching and developing black children.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So even when I come across like teachers in the news now that just kind of don't care as much, like it's a job for them. But for my teachers, it wasn't just a job. These people were additions of your family, like ancillary parents, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Miss Pillars, Miss Howitz, Miss Moy, all very, very different.
I love that you know their names.
Ethnic backgrounds, right? Miss Morath, Mr. Torgensen, all very, very different ethnic backgrounds, right? Some Asian, some white, but white, you know, you have German, you have Russian, Miss Lev, Mr. Karamaris, all of these people who look nothing like us, who really, really gave a damn about helping us become better people and really poured into that development. Prepared me to get shocked by the world is what they did.
Wow.
Because they loved and put their arms around. I remember Miss Moy's husband gave me my first set of comic books that got stolen out of my locker, and I cried for a week because I was really big into comic books as a child. But you have to understand, they set me up for the most massive culture shock in my life, mm-hmm. because every white person I ever met loved me, like out loud and intentionally. And I get to college, and I'm going to tell this part of the story really fast. I get to college. I'm on a full scholarship to play football. So I just graduated from high school, full scholarship. I'm about to play college football. I'm on the emotional high. Mm-hmm. I am in the parking lot waiting for the shuttle to take me to my dorm for the first time. So this is day one. I have not seen my dorm yet. The shuttle picks me up in the parking lot. I get on. I sit down. I got on the shuttle first. And the only way I would have noticed this is if I got on the shuttle first. Four white young ladies got on the shuttle after me. Three of them made it their business to not only sit as far away from me as possible, but to make fun of the one who had to take the only remaining seat by the time they got on, which was next to me. And from the parking lot to our dorm rooms, they just made fun of her. And she was not only hurt, but embarrassed. And I remember reaching out and touching her and her not being startled, which was comforting. And she looked at me like embarrassed for her friends. And I just told her, you don't have to apologize for them. I'm cool. But it was the first time I realized that things were different. And it was the first time of many times that I would be reminded of so. Mm.
And now, Proper propaganda. Watch it. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists with journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders.
Well, if you're just tuning in to Civic Cypher, I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. This is Civic Cypher.
Yes, indeed. Be sure to stick around. We got a lot more show in stow for yo. I didn't quite roll off as
you
well
tried,
as I thought it was
listen,
going to, but
you
hey,
tried.
I'm out here, man.
You know what I'm saying? And I got your back, bro.
Appreciate
that. We can
that.
Roll that vowel and make...
We're going to stress it out. We're going to do our Eminem right
it's
now.
It's in the Webster's, though. They look it up.
Listen, man, it's there. All right, so again, a lot more shows to stick around for. We're going to be talking about the origins of this show that you're listening to right now, Civic
Cypher.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, we're going to tell that story. We're also going to tell a little bit about the origin story of the National Urban League. Again, many folks are familiar with the NAACP, but we're going to take it back and perhaps even introduce you to another organization that does good work on behalf of Black and Brown people and marginalized folks, and another group that you can support in their efforts. And in fact, for our Become a Better Ally Baba segment, let's talk about donating to the Urban League.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, let's do it. So this segment comes via Hip Hop Weekly magazine, and we want you to donate. Again, historically, African Americans and underserved urban communities have fought to overcome policies of discrimination, economic and social injustices. Since 1910, the National Urban League has been a force of progress and empowerment. Through the 90 affiliates across the country, the Urban League delivers services and programs to nearly 2 million individuals in 300 communities each year. Although they have made progress, vast disparities remain in employment and education opportunities, quality housing, and basic health care. These disparities create a socioeconomic divide that they believe can change through empowering communities. The mission is to achieve equality for all Americans, and that depends on your support and commitment. For the millions of lives that they impact every day, a gift to the National Urban League means financial stability, a job opportunity, a better education, access to healthcare, and fair and affordable housing. Programs that are offered include college preparatory classes, mentoring activities, STEM education, science, technology, engineering and math, parental enrichment activities, workforce skills development, training in starting new businesses, homeownership classes, foreclosure prevention, nutrition education, health screenings, and assistance securing health insurance. So the Urban League definitely holds its own relative to its much more well-known cousin, the NAACP.
One time for the Urban League.
Yes, indeed. So bear that in mind and stick around for, again, the Way Black History Fact. Now, Q.
Yes, sir.
Tell us a story. How did Civic Cypher come to be?
I like how you asked me that in such a cavalier tone, as if this was just some small undertaking that we just decided to do one day. It's interesting when talking about Civic Cypher to listeners, to friends, to people that know us from radio and DJing, because the way that everything happened would give people the impression that Civic Cypher was our plan all along. Like this was something that we set out to do from the very beginning. And that could be and is very misleading. Ramses and I spent, you know, myself over a decade, Ramses much longer than that, in broadcasting and DJing, like music and talking into microphones, specifically for him. I don't like talking into microphones, but
I'm kind of good at it.
Yeah, that's been my brother's bag for a long time. The summer of George Floyd's murder really turned not just our community, not just our country, but the world on its side, or really upside down. The reaction, the public outcry, the very, very difficult to watch video. I came across that video again recently, maybe a few months ago, and it still made me cringe. It still made my stomach hurt. And then it still made me visibly angry, to where someone was like, "Yo, you okay?" And I had to like snap out of it. The way that all of us reacted, and I say all of us because a very, very large majority of people that I know reacted the same way, which was kind of refreshing. Donald Trump's election and the way the other side reacted to it revealed some other things to me about people that I know, and some that I consider myself close to. That was really heartbreaking and kind of emotionally and mentally damaging to see so many people stand on the opposite side of something that was so obviously and straightforwardly wrong and criminal and disgusting. I'd also become a father for the second time. And there was a lot of daddy daycare going on. And while I was home with my newborn daughter, Ramses and his sons were in the street and peacefully protesting just our rights to breathe. Just our rights to exist. Just our rights to matter. And us proclaiming that we mattered became a battle cry and somehow a controversial statement. The news during this time of civil unrest in our country was, I guess I can just blatantly say, unfair in a lot of ways to the people who were unknowingly risking their lives by peacefully protesting, because they were met with aggressive military style policing. And you just juxtapose that to almost no policing at all when our quote unquote patriots stormed our Capitol, premeditated and announced, met with little to no resistance from our military style police, who had just, you know, days or weeks earlier in that same city showed up in mass with full riot gear and battle shields to keep us from just simply again proclaiming that we matter and that we should be able to exist. We're not even saying that we should be able to thrive. just simply exist. It became more and more difficult for Ramses and I to be out in public amongst these people who were supporting that movement, looking them in their faces, and then going and getting behind our microphones and just talking about the Migos and Cardi B. Right? Someone had to say something about what was going on outside, because so many people were not giving a fair account of the happenings in our streets. The ironic part about all of this is that Ramses and I did not determine that we were the voices that need to do it.
Not at all.
And not because we didn't want to, but we just didn't want to. Imagine this. We're broadcasters working in radio.
Hip-hop radio.
And for lack of better, excessively popular and successful at it, to come to our broadcaster at the time and say, hey, can you guys give us another show? I know we have one, and I know we've had one, but can you give us another one? Just seemed like a lot to ask.
And there was no money involved.
I mean, but not that that would have been necessary, yeah, it wouldn't, right? We were in the streets for free. We would have been on the air for free. But I think it was less likely that we received pushback if we were not pitching something else for ourselves.
Right.
It wasn't about not being able to make money. It was about us saying, hey, this should happen, and we don't even have to do it. It was us trying to move ourselves out of the way so that it could happen. Not because we didn't want to, but like, okay, we're not asking for something else for us. We'll produce it. We'll even create the content, and you guys can have whoever you want talk about it. And initially, because they were human beings and didn't want to be looked at like monsters, they agreed that it was a good idea. And Ramses, with his optimistic heart and mind, heard that was a good idea and translated, oh, we about to do this. So Ramses left said conversation, I'll say, I won't even call it a meeting. And when he went back to the street, made sure that everyone knew, soon enough, you guys' voices will be heard. I know that the stuff that we're seeing on the news isn't fair, isn't honest, isn't even showing the nuance in the context of the things that we're dealing with and what our actual experiences are. And I know this because I'm out here with you, but I assure you, myself, and this is me speaking as Ramses, to everyone that we encounter, we will have a voice. I assure you of it, right? And then Ramses spent the next few months trying with as much grace as possible to remind these people of the great idea that they heard and seemed to show support for. And many of those conversations were met with affirmations. Not only did we say that was a good idea, but yeah, we should do something like that. You know, let's hear your ideas and let's put it into action. And then more weeks would pass. And then more weeks would pass. And finally, a tipping point happened, really unintentionally. Because even at this point, Ramses did not walk into the station intending to deliver an ultimatum or even hold anyone's feet to the fire. It was just really like, hey, remember that great idea you guys heard?
I got the studio ready, got the mics.
You think we might be able to actually follow through on that? And what happened next changed our lives professionally for always, at least, but maybe even for better. And there are so many different ways that this conversation could have happened that would have resulted in Civic Cypher not existing today. And us probably still working at that radio station. And that radio station still having the same name and call letters.
I own the trademark to that radio station now. I am the... they can't use that name in the state anymore, by the way.
How about that?
Petty fact. shout out to C. Bradley one time.
Yes, sir. So we understood the gravity of what we were asking by the time this conversation happened, because Ramses had now half a dozen times reminded them, right, gracefully, that this was something that they'd agreed to, and reminding them that it was absolutely necessary. And what Ramses was met with this time led him to make a decision for both of us because there are so many answers that we could have tolerated and just really had to grit and bear and just, okay, I guess we just have to accept that. But what they said next made a decision for us that would effectively, as far as we knew at the time, end our careers in radio. I'll let Ramses tell you what he was told.
Excellent setup. Meeting. Excellent setup there, Hugh. Bravo. So yeah, that's the long and the short of it. Yeah, we were out marching, protesting, you know, longtime broadcasters on the radio, doing hip hop radio in Phoenix, Arizona. I remember we, up until that point, we had a show, Radio Solstice, that we were doing, where we'd break new music and we'd, you know, talk about things, that sort of stuff. Man, we were having a ball. And then, of course, as you mentioned, George Floyd, you know, that stuff happens. We get out in the streets, we're protesting, we're marching. The protesters, the women from BLM Phoenix Metro, a woman in particular named Zara, she's a powerful leader, powerful voice in our community here and nationally. You can look her up. She's actually made a lot of national noise as well, but she was talking on a bullhorn. You remember that? She was on the bullhorn, and there's thousands of people at these protests, and the bullhorn doesn't go that far. So people are having to repeat what she's saying. So her delivery is more choppy than it should be. And yeah, okay, well, listen, we can do more. You know, Channel 15 is saying, or Channel 12 is saying that we were rioting and there was no riot. I'm there with my children. Everybody's cool. We're safe. We all get home. There's nothing to see here. But, you know, later they call it a riot. People were thinking BLM was coming to their house to rape them. All kind of crazy rumors were going around. I was hearing this from the actual people thinking that. And you know, we work in media. You know, you'll hear the song at the end of our show. It's a song called Proper Propaganda by the Dilated Peoples. Shout out to the Dilated Peoples one time. And there's a bar in that song that you'll hear when we close the show that says, journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back, you know? And so that's kind of the thought behind the show, which is, okay, if they're saying, as Q mentioned, if they're saying that they're saying something that's not true, well, we can just, we work in media. We can just go and do the same thing. So again, you know, we worked with.
We'll actually go and do the opposite. We don't want to do the same thing.
We can tell stories, yes, though. That's what I'm meaning to say. So we go to, you know, the program director of the old radio station. They've changed their name now. And the program director is no longer working there anymore. But yeah, ask back and forth. The whole time I'm buying equipment, setting up a studio. Because remember, it's COVID, so we couldn't bring guest into the studio. I as Q mentioned, I'm like, hey, you can send over an intern or a promo rep or somebody, whoever's next to do this public affairs type show. We're thinking it's going to be 30 minutes a week. You know, we're buying Rodecasters, which is a device that allows us to make programs like this outside of an actual station or studio. Spending our own money, this sort of stuff. And yeah, like you said, dragged us along. Hit me next week. You know, whatever was going on. And then finally, the program director said to me, hey, you know what, Ramses, I got to level with you. I don't want to do a black show. All right. So imagine that. Imagine a hip hop radio station with a program director who's not black. The owner was not black and the general manager was not black, telling the longest running employee there, because I was the person who had been there longer than anyone at that point, and one of the only black people functioning in a significant capacity, like a full-time-ish capacity. They knew who I was. You know, I worked with the NAACP for many years before I got there. I was a president of the Black Student Union. I was in college. You know what I mean? So I came with the pedigree and I helped them always stay on the right side of history. Whenever there were problems that came up, I would be the one to come and speak, this sort of stuff. They knew me. And they knew how important this sort of stuff was to me. They knew that I'm a fierce protector of my culture and I'm the great defender of all people who were born with, you know, what could be considered a strike against them. I just was born to love. I was made to do that. And far be it for me to go against my own nature. So they knew this.
And sometimes love looks a little different. And when I heard, I don't want to do a black show on a hip hop station that plays 70% black artists.
Higher.
But 100% black music in an environment where black employees aren't necessarily promoted in the way that they should be. I was very fortunate, but I recognize this is a hip hop station. Most of the people do not look black.
Are not black.
There you go.
We don't say don't look.
Yeah, are not black. I don't want to say that it's overt racism. I think it's just kind of like ingrained in people's minds that they think that black culture needs to be expressed through different faces in order for it to be palatable by a city where statistically black people are irrelevant. You know, statistically speaking, there's not a lot of black people in Phoenix, you know? So they would try to slap a white face or Hispanic face or whatever on black culture. But my argument has always been and still remains that if people can tune in to listen to black music, then they can listen to black radio hosts and black, you know, commentators and black thinkers and black everything, full stop, right? And I think that it is incumbent upon you, the powers that be, to familiarize the people, the masses, with an alternative reality that works for everyone, you know? And so this responsibility is something that I really held central to all of our conversations. But when he said that he didn't want to do a black show, he wrote my resignation, our resignation for us because, go ahead.
It's important to point this out because a lot of our ecosystem, and I almost make fun of Ramses on our show for being so hopelessly optimistic and hopeful and like always looking for the good. Our show producer, Maggie B. Noen, is another person who I think intelligently always gives the benefit of the doubt in a way that I sometimes refuse to. Because with the climate in the country being the way that it was, he could have successfully said to us, you know, guys, we really don't want to do a political show. We don't want to be divisive.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want to alienate our listeners. And we would have had to translate what that meant, but still probably digested it and kept going to work. And he knows that too. And he still chose
to say,
I don't want to do a black show.
That was so hurtful. And you got to think, when you know somebody for that many years, you know, and again, nobody's just the worst thing that they've done. I know a lot of people get mad at me for saying this, but that man that said that to me, he let me go and take care of my grandma when she was sick. That man let me take time off when my son was born so I could be in the hospital with my baby. You know, nobody's just the worst thing that they've ever done, but that was the wrong thing to say to the wrong person at the wrong time. And it forced my hand because I had told everybody, okay, I see you out here working. I'm not going to sit up on my radio throne, high horse, and just be the man and be cool and whatever. Nope, I'm out here with you. And if you need me, I'm coming. And when he said that to me, everything just came together like that. And I'm like, well, and then, you know, I wrote a resignation, which is still up on my social media. If you want to check it out, I'm at Ramses Jha. You got to scroll back to that time, but I think it was August 2020, somewhere now. You know, I wrote the resignation to the city. The city had given us our ratings for so many years, and I'd been on quite a bit longer than Q. So, you know, I was walking away from a career that was, I tried as much as I could, but it sort of became a part of my identity. You know what I mean? And as like kind of think about like chopping off a part of your body because it's the right thing to do, you know? And I knew who I was doing it for. It was for the people that were marching, the people of the city. I knew that they deserved better from the radio station. And by me staying there, that I would be complicit. And, you know, I kind of threw Q in there, but I knew I could, you know, me and Q were friends long before radio. We'd been friends forever. So I knew I could make that move and he would trust me to do it. You know, my resignation ended up getting shared
by thousands of people on social media, and you know, some folks reached out. One of the first folks is a guy named Ben Romero, DJ Complex in Phoenix, Arizona.
Shout out to Complex.
We love you, brother. At the helm of a station called Power 98.3. A shout out to all the programmers carrying this show right now, because you all are very important to me, and I've communicated with all of you. I love you dearly, and we appreciate you. But Complex was the first one with a FM signal to say, whatever you were trying to do over there, I mean, he's like, I read your resignation. Whatever you're trying to do over there, please come do it over here. And gave us a home. And then we had to come up with the show. And he gave us an hour instead of 30 minutes. And Dr. Westenberg, she was working on something with the NAACP called From the Circle to the Cipher, that has its roots in a more traditional African storytelling type of roots. And she said that I could use that name. And From the Circle to the Cipher didn't quite work, but Civic Cipher certainly did. And it was a better reflection of what was going on at the time in the country. She loved it. So there's our name. You know, my sister designed the logo. My brother gave us our FTP sites. Maggie B. Noen came along and she decided to lend her support and her expertise. And of course, having a Black woman's voice in the room. And then programmers around the country said, hey, we need that content as well, and we would like to carry that show. We partnered with iHeartMedia via Tony Coles, via Steve Earnhardt in Tucson. And, you know, now we're supported by you, our listeners. And, you know, we just want you to know that we're grateful for everything that has come our way.
I think it's important to say, as we, you know, finish up this story, Civic Cipher was born of that resignation, not the other way around.
We didn't know what it was going to
play in line. So then we quit radio. Like, no,
we had to figure it out.
That
quick.
Resignation meant that our careers were effectively over.
Yeah.
Civic Cipher came because of you guys, because of support, because of, like you said, people like Complex. We didn't know
it was going to look like this.
Yeah. We didn't have a plan.
All right. So now it's time for the Way Black History Fact. We're going to talk a little bit more about the Urban League. So today's Way Black History Fact comes from, or sponsored by rather, Hip Hop Weekly Magazine. So we'll read about a little bit of the background. The National Urban League was founded in 1910. The Civil War between the North and South had ended 40 years before, but the country was still deeply divided. And most former slaves remained locked in a system of political powerlessness and economic inequality. The new organization set two major goals: remove barriers to racial equality and achieve economic empowerment for the country's Negro citizens. When Congress removed civilian governments in the South and put former Confederacy under the rule of the U.S. Army, the South resisted violently. Ku Klux Klan groups attempted to restore white supremacy by murder and other forms of mayhem. Black codes were enacted in the South that severely limited the former slaves' legal rights and economic options. Some states limited the occupations open to Negroes. In other words, Black people can't be drivers, Black people can't be doctors, Black people can't be whatever. None allowed Negroes to vote or provided public funds for their education. In response, the Army conducted new elections in which the freed slaves could vote, while those who held leading positions under the Confederacy were denied the vote and could not run for office. Sounds dope, right? Anyway, the Army's intervention in the South ended in 1877. Womp womp. The newly formed legislatures in former slave states quickly adopted Jim Crow laws that again severely limited the civil rights of freed slaves and once more denied them the right to vote. There's an editor's note here. The Jim Crow laws, for those who don't know, were state and local laws enacted between 1876 and 1965. That's recent history there for you. They mandated racial segregation in all public facilities with a, quote, separate but equal clause for Negro Americans. In reality, this led to treatment and accommodations that were usually inferior to those provided for white Americans, and systematized a number of economic, educational, and social disadvantages. The Supreme Court's separate but equal ruling in Plessy versus Ferguson legitimized Southern segregation policies. The alternatives for former slaves were limited. They could work for white farmers as tenants or sharecroppers, barely a step above slavery, or they could leave the South. Many opted to migrate and move north to find a better life. By 1910, the Negro population had increased dramatically in urban areas of the North. With the population explosion, a new set of problems emerged. Remember, we're talking about the urban league.
Hence, Detroit, Michigan.
Boom. Talk to them. The co-founders, two people stepped forward at this time to provide leadership. One Negro, one white, one man, one woman. And together they founded the National Urban League. Their names were Ruth Standish Baldwin and George Edmund Haynes. Sorry. The multiracial character of the Urban League that they established still exists today. Ruth Standish Baldwin came from a family of New England colonists with a history of social activism. Baba. Her father was the editor of the Springfield, Massachusetts Republican, a graduate of Smith College. She was the wife of William Henry Baldwin Jr., president of the Long Island Railroad. The Baldwins were deeply concerned about the poor and disadvantaged. The health and welfare of Negro migrants were of particular interest. On the other hand, George Edmund Haynes, unlike Ruth Standish Baldwin, did not come from a background of privilege. His father was a laborer and his mother was a domestic servant with great ambitions for her son. When George Haynes completed his elementary education, the family moved from his birthplace in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, to the more cosmopolitan community of Hot Springs. At a point in history when educational opportunities for Negroes ranged from limited to non-existent, George Haynes's achievements were astonishing. In Hot Springs, he completed the limited educational opportunities available and went on to take high school level courses and college preparatory studies at the Agricultural and Mechanical University in Huntsville, Alabama. He received his bachelor's degree from Nashville, Tennessee's Fisk University and then a master's degree from Yale. Because he was an outstanding student, Yale awarded him an academic scholarship and he waited tables and stoked furnaces for his room and board. Together, Ruth Standish Baldwin and George Haynes founded the Committee on Urban Conditions Among Negroes. Within a year, three organizations, the Committee for Improving Industrial Conditions of Negroes in New York, the National League for the Protection of Colored Women, and the Committee on Urban Conditions Among Negroes merged to form the National League on Urban Conditions Among Negroes. On September 29th, 1910, in New York City, George Edmund Haynes became the executive secretary in 1910 and served in this capacity until 1918. Ruth Standish Baldwin served as president, board of trustees from 1913 to 1915. In 1920, the name was later shortened to the National Urban League. In 1918, Dr. Haynes left the National Urban League to become director of the U.S. Department of Labor's Division of Negro Economics. He left behind a well-planned and efficient foundation to help guide Negro migrants to better education, employment, and housing. Eugene Kinkle Jones became the second National Urban League Executive Secretary in 1918 and held the position for the next 23 years, a period of extraordinary growth. When he took office, the National Urban League had an operating budget of $2,500. 23 years later, the league had 58 affiliates and an annual budget of $2.5 million. Several subsequent leaders of the National Urban League were also leaders in the field of professional social work. This came from the National Urban League 100 Years of Empowering Communities booklet. It was authored by Ann Nixon. And again, a lot of people are familiar with the NAACP. The Urban League is also a major player in that space in terms of bringing equitable and equal treatment of Black and brown people in this country. But obviously the NAACP is older and it is just better known. But in terms of knowing all of the do-gooders in this space, you know, it's important for us to bring this to your attention with this platform that we've been, you know, given and developed, because we don't want to take credit away from ourselves and our producer, Maggie. So it's important that you know about the Urban League as well. And there are plenty of other organizations that we will get to in due time. But, you know, shout out to the Urban League keep on trucking, man. We love all that that you do. So with that in mind, that's going to do it for us here on Civic Cypher. Once again, I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
I remain, at least for now, Q Ward.
A.K.A. Q Dirty, right?
Shout out to my mom for Q Dirty. I'll tell that story one day too. Man, we need to Reverend Estella Seacrest nicknaming her son Q Dirty.
That's the one, man. Show produced by our producer, Ms. Maggie, aka Maggie B. Nolan, another one for the books. If you got love for us, hit the website, civiccypher.com. Submit any questions, any topics you want us to talk about. Make a donation. Again, the show is growing, and we'd like to keep growing. Your support really helps, and we plan on growing that number very soon. Your support will help us toward that end. Subscribe to the podcast. We got some numbers there as well, and that is looking great. Again, more support would go a long way. And follow us on all social media at Civic Cypher. And until next week, y'all.
Peace.
Too. We can strike back hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders. With press passes, we bring it to you as it happens. The streets love my crew for music and rapping. Street commander / beat expander. Here to fight the slander with the proper propaganda. What's happening? You got a question, then ask it. The news is just a TV show. Get past it. And this from a quiet wartime journalist.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
No matter where you are, everyone is always connected.